We were hopeful that the mayor would realize that the majority of the people of Anchorage did not support this kind of ordinance.
Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan makes a controversial decision on a controversial topic. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 17th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Coast Guard rescues 10 people in two separate boating incidents in Southeast.
They were on the beach, pretty wet and cold, but otherwise uninjured.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
This afternoon, Mayor Dan Sullivan issued a written statement that he has vetoed the anti-discrimination ordinance passed last week by the Anchorage Assembly. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
In a brief memorandum to the Anchorage Assembly, Mayor Sullivan announced he was vetoing the ordinance that would have forbidden discrimination against gays, lesbians, bisexual, and transgendered people. The ordinance passed last Tuesday evening, and this was the final day for Sullivan to veto it. He issued only the written statement and held no press availability. The mayor wrote, quote, "My review shows that there is clearly a lack of quantifiable evidence necessitating this ordinance. My review also shows that the vast majority of those who communicated their position on the ordinance are in opposition." Assemblymember Pat Flynn wrote the compromise at one passage from a trio of proposed ordinances. His version sought to afford protection against discrimination based on sexual orientation in matters of housing, employment, financial dealings, and public accommodations, while providing exemptions for churches and other faith-based organizations. Flynn was disappointed with the mayor's action.
I was hopeful that Mayor Sullivan would show what I would view to be some courageous leadership and allow this ordinance to become law. He chose not to. I think that's unfortunate. I feel badly for the thousands of Anchorage residents who will be disenfranchised by that decision.
The Assembly passed the ordinance by a 7-4 vote. That's one short of the number needed to override a mayor's veto. Flynn does not expect an attempt to do so.
If the votes aren't there, there's no point in embarrassing anybody in my mind. Unless I hear something remarkable, I suspect we will just move on.
Some Anchorage religious leaders said their churches supported the ordinance, but the two-month-long series of public hearings was dominated by the influence of conservative congregations, in particular that of Pastor Jerry Prevost and the Anchorage Baptist Temple. The pastor had led similar campaigns against gay rights dating back to the 1970s. Since the ordinance passed last Tuesday, Pastor Prevost had urged the thousands in his congregation to write the mayor's office, supporting a veto.
We were hopeful that the mayor would realize that the majority of the people of Anchorage did not support this kind of ordinance, and also from the input that there's really not a discrimination problem in our city, and that most large companies give some protection to the homosexual community already, and this would have adverse effects upon the small businessmen and religious people.
Jackie Buckley is with Equality Works, one of the primary backers of the anti-discrimination ordinance. Buckley says her group will continue its efforts. She questions the mayor's reference to no evidence of discrimination.
The reason that there isn't any record is that there's no law preventing that discrimination, so no one is keeping track, except for the anecdotal stories that were presented, many of them before the assembly, and in the 1 in 10 document and prima facie that were presented in the 80s and 90s.
Buckley said because her group had hoped the mayor would not veto the ordinance, they hadn't really thought about starting an initiative drive to put it on this April's ballot. "We were just taking it one step at a time," she said. Mayor Dan Sullivan's father, George, vetoed a similar anti-discrimination ordinance in the 1970s. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
State employees are now required to let the state archive their personal email accounts if they use them for state business. Under a policy released today but signed 10 days ago by Commissioner of Administration Annette Kreitzer, any private message sent or received concerning the state must be forwarded to the state system. Kreitzer says the policy order codifies existing unofficial practice.
what happens sometimes is with the proliferation of all of these various devices that people carry, your personal BlackBerry, your state BlackBerry or iPhone, and people who have their own laptop computers at home and their laptop computer at work, and it just makes it very clear that if you inadvertently are using your personal email account, that you need to make sure that you are copying your state email account.
Messages must be retained that have a public records requirement, and all messages older than 90 days will be retained for permanent archives. Kreitzer says she recognizes that the entire public records system, whether paper or electronic, depends on the willingness of the individual to follow through with the requirement. The formal policy is now in effect for all executive branch employees. Seven people were pulled from the water north of Juneau after the 20-foot Hughescraft skiff capsized near Tea Harbor. One man trapped under the skiff was reported as unresponsive by the Coast Guard. Rescuers administered CPR on board an Alaska State Trooper boat. It landed at Auk Bay, and an ambulance rushed the man to Bartlett Regional Hospital. Names of the people on board have not been released. The Coast Guard also rescued three boaters, including a 12-year-old child, this morning in Misty Fjords National Monument, capping off a three-day search. The search for the trio began Saturday night after family members reported the boaters overdue from a halibut fishing trip. KRBD's Deanna Garrison has the story.
50-year-old Clint Clarkson and 46-year-old Tracy Harrell of Ketchikan, as well as a 12-year-old child from Lewiston, Idaho, had been traveling in a 16-foot open skiff. Family members reported the three missing at 9:30 Saturday night. The Coast Guard began searching soon after. Unable to locate the missing boaters by 3 o'clock the following afternoon, the Coast Guard contacted the Ketchikan Volunteer Rescue Squad for assistance. KVRS Incident Commander Jerry Kiefer says a rescue squad dispatched a helicopter and fixed-wing aircraft Sunday afternoon. He says a search on Sunday was hampered by deteriorating weather conditions and diminishing light. Kiefer says family members also assisted in the search and were able to uncover some clues as to the whereabouts of the boaters.
Apparently they had chartered a aircraft to go look Sunday morning and had actually landed next to a boat up in the Bean Canal area. The owner of that vessel indicated that somebody matching their description had come by them asking for directions into Ketchikan. He gave directions and hadn't seen the boat since.
He says the search area was subsequently expanded to 4,500 square miles. Coast Guard spokesperson Sarah Francis says it was that information that helped searchers better pinpoint the missing boaters' location.
Their original float plan that they had left with family members had them down south of Ketchikan, around some islands. It wasn't until witnesses sighted them headed north, and that's where we located them.
A Coast Guard helicopter crew from Air Station Sitka located the missing boaters Monday morning at around 8 o'clock on a beach in Eastern Bean Canal, about 30 miles northeast of Ketchikan.
From what we understand, they were just avoiding bad weather conditions in the area. They had pulled their skiff up on the beach and they had made a fire there using a flare. Our MH-60 Jayhawk helicopter crew from Air Station Sitka located them.
Despite rainy and windy conditions, Kiefer says the boaters were in good condition.
They were on the beach, pretty wet and cold, but otherwise uninjured.
Rescuers searched a total of 811 miles of shore and sea over 3 days, according to the Coast Guard. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the debate over a plan to spray herbicide along the railroad.
If you read the label, it says that it's harmful to marine invertebrates, and depending on the concentration, it's harmful to a lot of other things, too.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The federal government has released the longest and most comprehensive study of glaciers in North America, and it shows they're melting at an increasing rate as the climate warms. The study, out this month from the U.S. Geological Survey, focuses on three glaciers, two in Alaska and one in Washington State, that have been studied for nearly 50 years. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, the length and consistency of the study is what makes it so unique.
The three glaciers in the report were selected as benchmark glaciers because they're representative of others in their region, and scientists have returned to them season after season for nearly five decades. The plan to study them stretches back to the International Geophysical Year in 1957, says the new report's lead author, Edward Josberger, a research oceanographer at the Washington Water Science Center. Similar to the recent International Polar Year, it was a time for scientists to study the Earth, including the far north.
What happened was there was a group of glaciologists and scientists selected a number of glaciers and said, we need to observe these glaciers, measure them, measure their change in length, size, thickness as the years pass to give us an idea of, you know, how climate is changing in these areas.
The three glaciers in the benchmark program are Golcana in the Alaska Range, Wolverine in the Kenai Mountains, and South Cascade in Washington State. Not only have scientists looked at them with regularity, at least every spring and fall, but Josberger says they developed methodical techniques.
Basically, we go out to the glacier and we'll drill a hole in through the snow or into the ice, or maybe just in the ice itself, depending on if there's snow cover. And we'll place a big long stake in it, and we'll periodically return and measure the height of the snow or ice surface on that stake.
Josberger says from that, they compute the mass balance, the difference between the amount of snowfall on the glacier and the amount of snow and ice that melts and runs off or is lost as ice chunks or water vapor. They take other measurements, too, for things like temperature distribution and runoff. What the scientists have learned is this. In the beginning, back in the 1960s, Josberger says the glaciers were, on average, slowly declining. But they also grew at times, and Josberger says fluctuations were because of regional circulation in the atmosphere and oceans. But in the mid-1980s, Josberger says the glaciers started shrinking consistently and in a way similar to each other. He says that shows an influence greater than local circulation.
After that, there's something happened, and there's been more uniform warming across the whole area. So there's been a change in what's driving these glaciers, and it's certainly on a larger scale and certainly indicative of climate change.
Josberger says the three benchmark glaciers are retreating at virtually the same rate. That's significant because two of the glaciers are maritime and the third is alpine, and all three are in different climates. Few other glaciers around the world have been observed for so long, according to another of the study's authors. Shad O'Neill is a glaciologist with USGS in Anchorage. He says not only did all the glaciers start to retreat, but that retreat sped up.
They're all losing mass, but that rate of change increased in about the early 90s. And that's something that's mirrored in reports by the World Glacier Monitoring Service. The timing isn't exact around the world, but you can see this trend of accelerated mass loss in the Alps and in the Andes and in the Himalaya, mirroring what we see in Alaska and Washington.
O'Neill says the team hopes to keep the long-running study going as long as funding doesn't lag. He says they can do more with advanced technology combined with the old-fashioned measurement techniques.
The way that the research is headed right now is to try and combine the observations that we make in the field with satellite observations so we can get a more certain sense of how valid the changes that we see on these particular glaciers are on a regional scale.
The scientists say remote sensing could lead to more detailed observations, which could help determine exactly how much water is coming down from the melting glaciers. The Alaska glaciers in the study have both lost nearly 15% of their mass, while Washington State's South Cascade Glacier has lost nearly a quarter of its mass and almost half its volume. For a link to the glacier study, visit our website, APRN.org. In Washington, D.C., I'm Libby Casey.
An Alaska Railroad plan to eradicate weeds using chemicals along a stretch of track has raised the ire of environmentalists. Some say the plan is harmful, but railroad officials say it is required by federal authorities. APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Public hearings on the weed eradication plan were held in Seward, Whittier, and Anchorage. Tim Thompson, spokesman for the Alaska Railroad, says the weed control program is in response to a warning from the Federal Railroad Administration. The Alaska Railroad got a letter from the FRA in April indicating fines, speed restrictions, and possible track closure if a program to control vegetation along the tracks were not implemented.
What we are looking at doing is actually applying this weed killer to about 30 acres in the Seward yard and about 30 miles of actual track, not onto the sides of it, but on the actual track bed between Seward and Indian. We are looking at a conservative approach of about 30 miles in this area because what we've really taken into account during our permit application is water bodies that lie near or are next to our rail bed. And we've created anywhere from a 200 to a 100-foot buffer zone for this product that we're applying to use.
Thompson says the railroad will continue to cut back vegetation to the sides of the tracks manually. He says the railroad has safety concerns about weeds and roots growing up through the track bed.
Because of the many, many years that we've not been allowed to take care of this root system through a chemical means, we're able to get rid of the top portion of this vegetation, but it's the root system which is destabilizing the rail bed.
The railroad has applied to the State Department of Environmental Conservation for a permit to spray chemical weed killers along the railroad right-of-way from Seward to Indian. Two spoke out against the plan at a public hearing in Anchorage. Pam Miller, who heads Alaska Community Action on Toxics, says the weed control program is a bad idea. And Jim Sykes, who describes himself as a concerned citizen, says he's been fighting railroad herbicide plans since the late 1970s.
The herbicide tends to last longer and it can move faster in certain instances where we get a lot of rain or something. So if you read the label, it says that it's harmful to marine invertebrates, and depending on the concentration, it's harmful to a lot of other things, too.
DEC's Karen Hendrickson is reviewing the railroad's application. She says the weed killer the railroad wants to use is nothing out of the ordinary.
They've requested to use a product called Aquamaster, and that is a registered herbicide that has an active ingredient of glyphosate. And glyphosate is the same kind of herbicide that's found in home use herbicides that you can get at your local stores.
The railroad last applied for a chemical weed control permit in 2006. That application was denied because of DEC concerns about the effect of herbicides on water. This time around, Hendrickson says there is a difference.
There's a couple of differences in this proposed project. The first difference is that the product that they're requesting to use is actually approved for use in on aquatic plants and can be applied directly to surface water like ponds and streams. The other difference is that even though it would be legal to apply to water, the railroad has come up with a much better method for identifying and excluding spraying in any of the areas that has water nearby.
The railroad wants to implement the plan starting next summer. The FRA has been citing the Alaska Railroad for violations and defects regarding uncontrolled vegetation since 1997, and the latest contact from the FRA in April names 47 new violations by the railroad for out-of-control weeds. Thompson says the chemical weed eradication program will enable adequate track inspections and reduce employee slip and fall injuries, and the railroad is working with the University of Alaska on studies to determine the chemical's migration into soil. But Sykes says he'd like to take a look at some of those violations and questions why there are suddenly so many of them.
The railroad has indicated that this is a toehold. If they get the DEC permit this year for Seward to Indian, they fully expect to apply to spray the rest of the railroad all the way to Fairbanks the next year. So it's the old foot in the door trick. Traveling salesman used to use it all the time.
Hendrickson says a decision on the railroad's request won't be coming anytime soon.
We're actually going to spend quite a bit of time doing the research and the background documentation before we make a decision, and we've allowed plenty of time because we know this has been a controversial topic in the past.
The public comment period on the weed control plan is open until September 15th. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Core Alaska President Dennis Wheeler says cash flow is good and the company is ready to get started at the Kensington Gold Mine. He says Core has been mobilizing to begin work on the tailings facility, waiting for the go-ahead from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that finally came on Friday.
we want to clearly be on the ground here in the next 2 weeks so that we can complete the 2009 construction plan that we've had in place for some time.
The mine is located about 45 miles northwest of Juneau in the Berners Bay watershed. After a three-year legal battle on tailings disposal, settled in June by the U.S. Supreme Court, the Corps of Engineers has reauthorized the Kensington's permit to deposit mine waste into Lower Slate Lake. Wheeler says 90% of the earth has already been moved for the tailings dam, and he expects a good construction season yet this fall.
I'm very confident we're going to be able to complete enough work now and maintain our schedule for production in the third quarter of next year.
But the company still has a hiring freeze in place, and Wheeler says he doesn't know when hiring will actually begin. About 40 mine workers were laid off last fall. The company blamed the layoffs on the litigation, but it was also having a cash flow problem. Wheeler says Coeur now has a solid balance sheet due to the startup of production at silver mines in Bolivia and Mexico. Last month, Coeur sold its silver holdings at an Australian mine to help pay for Kensington construction. It will cost about $80 million to complete tailings plant construction. By the time the Kensington is up and running, Coeur Alaska will have invested about $300 million in the project. Meanwhile, the company that trains and hires mine employees isn't sure what to tell those calling about jobs. Randy Wanamaker runs BBC Human Resources Development. He says schedules for hiring are contingent upon construction contracts at the mine.
And then they'll hire regular employees that will work for them, that will help with camp operations and supervising the construction.
About 300 workers will be involved in tailings plant construction. Once in operation, the mine will employ about 200.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples.
August is living up to its standard as Fairbanks' wettest month. After a record dry July in which less than a tenth of an inch of rain fell, Fairbanks has received nearly a half inch of rain so far this month, and there's more in the forecast. Meteorologist Matthew Kidwell says there will be breaks in the rain, but that the general pattern is wet.
We have a big low-pressure system up in the Arctic, and then little waves are cycling around. And so every few days, one comes by and brings us some more moisture.
Kidwell says, on average, Fairbanks receives 1.74 inches of rain during the month of August. All the rain has helped snuff out massive wildfires that have burned across the region for weeks. Crews have finished removing diesel fuel from the sunken oil industry supply ship Monarch in Cook Inlet. The ship sank in January near the Granite Point platform about 16 miles from Nikiski, and the fuel recovery began in June. KDLL's Ben Stanton reports.
Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Program Specialist Steve Russell says crews did a good job removing about 12,000 gallons of fuel.
The conditions that we were trying to work in down there, the divers were trying to work in, were some of the more difficult that divers encounter when they do this type of work, and they did an exceptional job.
Workers from Global Diving first removed about 950 gallons in June, then the mooring for the staging ship Perseverance started slipping because of powerful tides, so they brought in a smaller ship. Russell says a larger boat had more room for supplies. But it was especially difficult getting divers in safely because the Monarch is lying upside down.
The safety aspects of having a diver crawl under the vessel and then enter the vessel, just at this time anyway, just outweighed the potential environmental risks. The safety aspects of doing that are very involved.
The Monarch sank with an estimated 30,000 gallons of diesel on board. After the recovery, that leaves about 20,000 gallons of fuel unaccounted for. Russell says they have not determined how much has leaked into the water and how much might still be trapped in other parts of the boat.
We decided to hold off on that phase of it to where the diver could actually go inside the vessel and determine if this missing product is still trapped in the vessel there. We certainly haven't ruled that out.
Russell says there are a few ways to determine if the fuel is still inside. Hot tapping is drilling holes through the hull to suck out remaining fuel, but he says the stability of the vessel needs to be determined before they try that. The removal of the ship itself also needs to be addressed. The Monarch remains about 6 feet away from the Granite Point platform. Coast Guard Captain John Kenyon says the ship has not moved since it sank, but if it's not possible to remove it from the water, leaving the vessel where it is can pose problems.
Well, I think the risks are somewhat unknown, but of course if it were to move and if it were to come closer or hit the platform leg, it's near the number one leg, that could cause damage.
Other options include moving the Monarch to another part of the inlet and burying it, but whatever they decide, Kenyon says they will need to do it before the cold weather returns. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
A researcher with the National Marine Fisheries Service has just wrapped up a 2-week effort to try to get a better understanding of what kinds of creatures live in the nearshore environment of Bristol Bay. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The study featured a chartered 32-foot Bristol Bay salmon vessel that put out nets in and around Nooshigak Bay and some of the areas to the west of the Nooshigak Peninsula. The project is the brainchild of fisheries biologist Olaf Ormseth, who says what they found can easily be summed up with three words: shrimp and smelt.
Almost every single haul had at least some shrimp, and it's a type of shrimp. They're krangon shrimp, so they're different from the kind of typical commercial shrimp. And then there were rainbow smelt everywhere. You know, there must just be an unbelievable number of smelt out there.
Ormseth doesn't have an explanation for the large number of smelt documented during his study, but if funding is available, he hopes to come back in the winter to do some additional sampling. Ormseth says one of the most surprising things he found during the 2-week sampling effort was how similar Nooshigak Bay and the areas to the west are in regards to the kind of fish that live in the nearshore environment.
I'd expected there to be a really big difference in both the amount of stuff that we would catch and the diversity, like the number of species and the types of species.
Ormseth says the further west they went, the more yellowfin sole and hair crab that ended up in the nets. He believes that getting a better understanding of what lives in the nearshore areas will allow both federal and state researchers to fill in gaps in the current research, especially in regards to juvenile fish.
So like the yellowfin sole that we caught were all, you know, maybe a year old at most. And so just kind of for a bigger understanding of some of the commercial fish populations, you know, it's essential for us to sort of know where the younger ages are hanging out and be able to understand some of the factors that, you know, influence survival.
The sampling project that just wrapped up was conducted on a budget of just $63,000, and Ormseth will be putting together a paper outlining the results of his research. However, that will take several months. Despite the intense commercial fishing activity in the spring and summer for both salmon and herring in the Togiak and Nooshigak Bay areas, there have been very few studies of the nearshore habitat. Ormseth believes his study can help provide some baseline habitat information that could be useful to state fishery managers and could also be incorporated directly into the shore zone mapping program. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ben Stanton in Soldotna, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at PennAir.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.